Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We've been talking about the power of food and identity on today's show and passing down recipes across generations. We started with Michelle Zahner, who blended together the stories of food with memories of her mother in her book Crying in H Mart. And we're ending today with our next guest, New York Times cooking writer Eric Kim, who decided he was going to write a cookbook. He moved back home to Atlanta to live with his mom, Jean Kim, and although he had eaten her food his whole life, he realized there was so much he didn't know about her process, and there was so much to learn. In a New York Times article called A Year of Cooking with My Mother, he writes lovingly about the 9 months he spent cooking with his mom, what they made, and what he learned. I'm glad Eric Kim can join us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have memories of cooking with your mom or your grandma? What did she teach you? What is a recipe that you inherited that you still make today? Our number is 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280 to tell us all on the air. You can also tweet to us or send us a DM via Instagram. Our handle is the same for both, at All of It WNYC. So, Eric, when you decided to write your cookbook, Korean American, it's going to be out next year, did you always know it was going to be a project you shared with your mom?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the only way for me to write about it in an authentic way, you know? I did try to write the first few chapters by myself in New York because I got the book deal right at the start of lockdown in New York, and I found that the recipes just didn't work. And so I drove down with my dog, and then the book started writing itself, not least because, you know, I was also writing about the dinners we were sharing and the daily life that we were, you know, inhabiting together in that house. And it was this really surreal experience of past and present kind of merging together. And it was kind of the perfect environment to write a book about my mom, essentially. And then she kind of came in very clearly as the subject of the book. And then everything happened very quickly after that.
As you started to tackle and write down your family recipes and started testing them at home, what was that experience like for you? Because you're, on one hand, you're a family member and a son, and then on the other hand, you're a food professional.
Yeah. I think one funny thing that happened in the beginning was there was a lot of bickering because we're both very similar, have very strong personalities, and have very strong culinary identities, I think. But ultimately, we sort of kind of started to see the merits of each other's styles. And you know, I sort of went into reporter mode, and I think that was the one way for me to kind of separate myself and to be able to really do her justice and do her recipes and her stories justice. But it was mostly just really fun. We hung out together every day, and yeah.
So let's forget reporter mode. Let's talk about just kid mode. What was your experience like with food with your mom when you were growing up?
Oh, man. I always say that I'm not going to be good at doing PR for this book because I always like want to cry when I think about it. So I cry when I start talking. But, you know, when I was a kid, I definitely always stumbled into the kitchen. And, you know, when she was making kimchi, for instance, on the floor, I was always there right next to her watching it because I always liked, you know, the sounds and I think it induced ASMR in me before I knew what ASMR was. And, you know, she would always just kind of wrap up a little morsel of napa cabbage and kind of let me taste it. And that's why taste memory is so important. I do think, you know, there is a science to recipe development. Of course, I'm a recipe developer, but there's also a great art to it. And I think, you know, years later when I moved out and went to college and wanted to try my hand at kimchi for the first time, it was a really good jar of kimchi. And I'd never made it before by myself, but because I just knew what it was supposed to taste like, I was able to approximate it. But certainly, there's definitely just so much more you can get when you have the subject in front of you and your subject happens to be your mother. Yeah.
My guest is Eric Kim, New York Times food reporter and cooking writer. You may have read his piece, A Year of Cooking with My Mother. And if you haven't, you should read it this Mother's Day weekend. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have memories of cooking with your mother or grandmother? What did she teach you? What recipe did you inherit that you still make today? Or maybe your guys are cooking via Zoom in the past year with each other. We'd love to hear your experiences. 646-435-7280. Let's go to line two, and Marge is calling in. Hi, Marge. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi, thanks. My pleasure to talk to you. So I had a grandmother who lived to be 109, and she was a really haughty, imperious woman. And she made this dish that she called strudel. And she was very difficult, but she was a very good cook. She made a dish she called strudel, which is not the strudel that's the rolled thing that most of us think about. But everyone in the family thought this was the best dessert there was on the face of the earth. My mother didn't make it. She found it very difficult to handle the thin dough. So I asked her how to make it to show me, and she said, you'll have to speak to Grandma. I called my grandmother, and she said, well, the only way I can show you, dear, is if you pick me up and bring me there for the weekend, which was her way of doing things. So I did just that. She taught me to make it. I learned to roll out the very, very thin layers of dough. And at that point, I was in my 30s. I had two young children, and, you know, I was somewhere in life, somewhere along the way in life. But she showed me how to make it. She left, and then I made it on my own. And when I did, despite the fact that I was where I was in life, I finally felt like I was an adult. I was a woman now because I could make Grandma Jenny's strudel.
I'm so glad.
In fact, that was the beginning of the point. I'm a food professional, and I ended up following my passion for cooking, but it was Grandma Jenny's strudel.
Buried the lead. Marge, thanks for calling in. I'm curious, that. Eric, did your mom have any recipes that were kind of hard for you to get out of her?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I have a whole section in the book when I introduced her called The Tiger in the Hand, and just this idea in mind that I'm the hand that's like, you know, reaching into her mouth and trying to pull them out of her because she's so circuitous. And, you know, moms are really bad at sharing exactly how they make it, so you just have to watch them. But, yeah, it was definitely, there are certain recipes that were tough to get out of her.
Let's go to Rajat on line one, who's calling from Manhattan. Rajat, thanks for calling in and sharing your mom's recipe. What is it? Rajat, are you there?
Hi.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, wow. Sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry. It's Raja. So I just wanted to share this recipe to me, which is very comforting. I call it my mom's Pertutti tomato sauce, and it's a recipe that she devised back when she was living in New York in the 1980s and going to grad school at Columbia. She always tells about how she used to go with her brother or my dad, who she was dating at the time, to an Italian restaurant called Pertutti, and they had this amazing tomato sauce that had artichoke and mushroom in it. And so, you know, when she moved away, she figured out, you know, how to make it herself. And ever since then, I feel like she's been making it for 40 years now. It's just one of those dishes that everyone tastes and is like, wow, this is absolutely delicious. And we have one family friend who will, you know, forego the pasta and just eat it as a soup. And so what this recipe does for me, sort of apart from being a very, you know, comforting dish that I know what I'm going to get when I make it, and I know exactly what notes it's going to hit. It also sort of brings me back to a time when I can sort of imagine, you know, my mom living here in the 1980s, my dad at the same time, who both of them had come to the U.S. during the Lebanese Civil War. So it allows me to imagine what it was like for them, you know, when they were living in New York.
Raja, thank you for sharing your story. My guest is Eric Kim. He wrote the piece, A Year of Cooking with My Mother. We'll have more with Eric after a quick break. We'll get to some more calls. Diana's got a handwritten recipe book. We've got grandmothers teaching Lebanese food. We've got some great calls lined up. Stay with us. This is All of It. My guest this hour is Eric Kim. He wrote a piece in the New York Times called A Year of Cooking with My Mother. He's working on a cookbook due out in March 2022 called Korean American Cooking. So, you know, it's interesting. You quote a columnist and cookbook author, Nigella Lawson, Eric, in your piece. And the quote is this. Quite often you cook something the way your mother did before you. What's an example of that for you?
Definitely her kimchi is very particular to her. She adds Korean plum syrup. It's called mechujang, and it's really wonderful. And pine nuts. I think that's her secret. I've never really had other kimchis with pine nuts. So, and those things you don't realize are particular until you kind of go out and live in the world and realize that it's your mom's food that does that. Yeah.
There are also some traditions. I'll give you an example of one from my family. So, you know, Black Southern family, my grandparents. And my mom, even as a kid, you know, and I remember she's a very elegant woman, she always put bacon drippings into a jar and left it on the stove. And I told somebody that recently, and they were like, oh, they were kind of trying not to be horrified, but they were. And I said, you know what? Go to Sur La Table right now and look. And they are selling, like, these very pretty little artisanal bacon dripping jars.
Of course they are,
right?
She's a smart woman. That's a good trick. Yeah.
Is there something like that with your mom, like something that is just such a good hack that somebody might raise an eyebrow to, but you know it's great and the rest of the world will know it's great soon?
Oh, yeah. It's less a hack and more a warning. She warned me against using pineapple as a marinade for meats. And one day, you know, again, me being like, you know, impudent, I was kind of like, I decided to marinate some beef and try grilling it just to prove her wrong. And of course the meat just totally melted into the grill pan and it turned into glue, and she was right. And you should always listen to mom. But with that knowledge, I was able to marinate other kinds of meat, and it turns out that the shorter marination time matters, and it actually works really well.
Let's get some more calls in here. Diana is on line 7. Hi, Diana. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me. My grandmother was a professional baker. She came here from Germany in the early 20s. And my mom was not a cook, but she learned very quickly. She had to. And she kind of inspired my sister and I to get in the kitchen and learn, you know, some of my grandmother's recipes. So during COVID, I had this cookbook that my grandmother had handwritten, and it was all of her recipes from what she worked at Schraff's, and she also was the head baker at the former Stern's Luncheonette in Manhattan.
Oh, wow.
And I went through the recipes, and I had to bring them down to some meaningful quantities because I don't normally bake with 15 eggs and 7 cups of flour. And so it was a bit tedious, and then there were no steps, so many times I'd have to figure out, you know, the methodology behind, you know, her baked goods. And that was my COVID project. And I felt like it was, obviously for many, it was a very lonely time. But for me, I felt like I was reconnecting with my mom and my grandma through the recipe.
Wonderful.
What a great story. Thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Joan on line 8. Joan is working on a family recipe. Hi, Joan. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yes, my grandmother made a wonderful pineapple upside down cake. And since I don't have a recipe, I'm still looking to find a recipe that has the firm texture of the cake that was under the pineapple and the cherries, sugar. It's most like the Greek cakes that I've seen recipes for and tasted.
Joan, thanks
and
for
at the other end of the spectrum, my grandmother cooked kidneys, beef kidneys. So I wasn't afraid to try organ meats, and I have found kidneys in local supermarkets. And I don't fix it the way she did, but I enjoy it very much. And I found you don't have to cut out the fat in the middle. You can cut it in finger-thick slices, quickly sauté on each side so it's still pink. Delicious.
Delicious.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. That's an interesting, you know, some of these recipes, you know, we fear they're going to disappear if we don't write them down, Eric. Was there one, aside from the kimchi, that you wanted to make sure you really got from your mom and that you got her to tell you how to actually make it?
Oh, yeah, definitely the galbitang. It's this short rib soup that seems very simple, but actually it took me forever to kind of perfect. And that's the problem. It's the translation. Even with her standing right there next to me, it's hard to kind of replicate something that you do, you know, naturally anyway, you know, onto the page. But yeah, the Kaibutan was definitely a particular one.
But you flipped the script a little bit because you made sheet pan bibimbap. This may have changed my life.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite dishes. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can do this. how is it traditionally made versus how you came to give it like sort of the Melissa Clark sheet pan treatment?
Oh, I love Melissa. Yeah, there's certainly, you know, certain gatekeepers who are like, bibimbap has to be like this. But actually, bibimbap, you know, in my family, but especially in other families, even in Korea, you know, there are many contexts. You know, if you are starting from scratch, you might be sautéing each separate vegetable because the point is to keep those color blocked, you know, portions in your bowl. But then, you know, the home cooked version is really just a fridge raid. You take out the empty, you take out some of the leftover banchan in your fridge, which are these side dishes that are already prepared in advance, and you sort of mix up a bowl with some gochujang. Sometimes it's doenjang, which is like a fermented, you know, soy paste, and like, you know, so I guess for me, it was out of necessity. I came downstairs. I had some vegetables that were sort of drying up, and I threw them all in a sheet pan, and it worked. It was really good. Not just that, it was caramelized and, you know, reduced. The water was gone from these vegetables, so they became very concentrated in flavor, and it was a really fun way to kind of show my mom that a different way to do it, and to do it, you know, in a more hands-off way. So, yeah.
I have an amazing message from Instagram someone sent us. My Jewish grandmother, known by all as Ganga, was an amazing cook and an even better baker, but she would never share her recipes even with family and never wrote them down. The most infamous story is that the synagogue did a cookbook fundraiser one year and everyone was so excited to finally have Ganga's honey cake recipe, but the joke was on them. She left out an ingredient and to this day, no one knows what it was.
That's so great.
Oh, that is such really a good story. Let's try to get a couple more calls. Kathy is on line 9. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. It's a fascinating topic. I have great memories of my mother who passed when she was 99, and she came from a very large family. And until the mid-50s, she cooked and baked as her mother did on a coal stove. And here she was. Even at the age of 98, she was sitting in the living room. The grandchildren are there. We learned everything about cooking, baking, how to make noodles, pies, cakes, cookies, cook, you know, anything. A lot was just by watching her is how I learned to cook. And the cookies were in the oven, and she's in the living room, and she sniffs in the air and goes, the cookies are done. In 98 years, she never lost that sense of she didn't need. Okay.
Internal clock.
And he was amazing. And the other thing is, you know, they grew up kind of poor and they had the ability to make something out of very little. Okay. Mm. And we always had fresh fruits and vegetables. We did all the canning and everything like that. And the area of the country is like, they grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania. There were a lot of people that were hunters and deer, rabbit, squirrel was sometimes what's for dinner. And but it's a real art to make those things edible. Like they would do ground deer and wrap it in bacon and make like a meatloaf out of it was one of the recipes and various sauces and everything else. But it's, something probably a lot of people don't want to think about. But again, to survive.
Thank you so much for calling in. Let's try to squeak another call in here. Randy on line 1. Hi, Randy. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi, how are you?
Doing
Am
great.
I on the air?
You are. Share your wonderful story.
So I just wanted to say that neither my mother worked full time and my grandmother lived with us. And my grandmother, despite she was working full time as well, she would do most of the cooking. And it was very mediocre except for her stuffed cabbage, which was quite good, sweet and sour. But she'd never teach me how to make it because the cleanliness of the kitchen was always most important. She wouldn't take the chance that I might get a spot on the stove. So I was unable to really, I loved food until I got married and had the wonderful luck to have a fabulous mother-in-law who had all the patience to teach me from the time I was 17 when I first met her, all her wonderful recipes. It wasn't then until I realized that I was able to do it myself. So when my son got married, you were, prior to this, you were talking to somebody about losing recipes, being concerned mm-hmm. about the loss of recipes. Mm-hmm. When my son got married, and this probably was not an original idea, but I decided to give him and his wife a book of recipes. So I compiled a book of my favorite recipes from my relatives and all of my best friends' recipes and their friends' recipes. And I gave it to them the day after they got married. I printed a copy for all of their friends at the wedding brunch. And so they now have a book with all my favorites, and I hope they use it and refer to it long after I'm gone.
Love that. So thank you so much for sharing that story. That's so great. My guest is Eric Kim. You might want to read his piece, A Year of Cooking with My Mother. Eric, what are some of the details about the way your mom cooks that you miss as a kid that you really appreciate now?
Yeah, I think a lot of them were on the stovetop because A, I wasn't tall enough to see, but also she kept us away from the fire and she hated us like using knives or anything. So one really big thing was I noticed that she blooms her gochugaru, which is like a Korean red pepper powder, in butter. And that smell is so wonderful. It's almost like a caramel. And that's something that I do now in a lot of my cooking. I think it's one main thing is just realizing how many things that I've like gained from those 9 months. I cook completely differently now. And I think that's just proof that you can change no matter how old you are. And she's also, you know, changed a little too from the things that I've taught her. So
we've talked about all the great things, Eric. What was tough about living and cooking with your mom aside from you admitting to being a terrible roommate?
Oh yeah. I think the main thing was that when you move back home with your mother, you become a 17-year-old again. There's no, you know, you're not an adult anymore. So, but I also was very messy, and I was laughing during Randy's story because I just made such a mess every day, and she hated it. And I got a little better over time, but I think that was something funny that I was sort of like the sloppy roommate that she couldn't stand.
What's the recipe that you're really excited for people to know about?
Oh, the kimchi jjigae for sure. It's on NYT Cooking, which is our cooking app, and it's at the bottom of the New York Times article. It's a kimchi jjigae with ribs. You know, kimchi jjigae is this homey soul food for so many Koreans out there, but it has many, many variations. But my mother's version has baby back ribs, which are really indulgent and special. And it's just so good because you're sort of gnawing at these ribs in between bites of fresh white rice. And, you know, people think that ribs are supposed to be barbecued and sticky, but if you've never had a braised rib, I think you haven't lived.
Eric Kim's piece is called A Year of Cooking with My Mother. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. That was so fun.
And listeners, thanks for calling in as well.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.